Luther, again, just to make a general comment, it really does, what I've described so far, really does point to Luther's personal existential struggles as being critical to his theological history. Again, I think talking about yourself in writing is an antisocial habit, by and large, but is very good for the historians who come after you. Calvin doesn't talk a lot about himself, but is therefore that much less interesting, I think, to study as a figure. Luther talks about himself a lot. Very obnoxious on one front, but very helpful when you're a historian. We know a lot about Luther's existential struggles in a way that, for example, with Calvin, did Calvin have an existential struggle before he became a Protestant? It's hard to tell. He tells us that his conversion was subito, which means suddenly or unexpected in the Latin. It doesn't really allow us to extrapolate or to work out exactly what went on. But with Luther, we certainly know that there were massive psychological struggles that preceded his Reformation breakthrough. Second thing, Luther, of course, is teaching in a medieval university. A couple of things. 1510, he travels to Rome as part of a delegation of the conservative wing, the observant wing of the Augustinian order, to deal with some controversies that were then taking place within the order. Rome will have a huge impact on him. You know, if you've ever been to Rome, it is an amazing city. Rome has, Luther's visit to Rome of 1510 fixes Rome in his mind. He is both bowled over by the opportunities for piety as he then understood it. Rome has so many relics. You know, he's able to crawl up the stairs to the upper room that have been brought to Rome. But it's also stunning to him the level of corruption that he sees in Rome. And I think in his later writings, he'll always have this strange, strangely ambivalent towards Rome as a city. It's a remarkable, if you've ever been there, it is a remarkable place. I remember some years ago I was there, and on the one day I went to the Gregorian University and looked in the library, and found out that the seminary students at the Gregorian University, I think, need to be able to speak 5 modern languages because the faculty are drawn from all over Europe, and you have to be able to sit through lectures in French, German, Italian, English, Spanish. It used to be they'd lecture in Latin. If you've ever read Frederick Copleston, a great Jesuit historian of philosophy, he taught at the Gregorian and hated lecturing in Latin. He, in his autobiography, tells the story that there was a rule that you had to lecture in Latin if more than one language group was represented in the class, but you could always quote original sources in the original language. So what Fred Copleston would do, he would quote endless bits of complicated English from original sources in his class until all of those who weren't super comfortable with English had left, and then he was able to just lecture in English. But I was staggered at the Gregorian University and the sheer level of intellect that was required even of students there. And yet 2 days later, I was in Padua and I lined up with all of the old ladies to go and see the pickled vocal cords, tongue, heart of St. Anthony of Padua. It's a rather undignified sort of how we get. When Anthony died, he died halfway between Padua and somewhere else, might have been Siena or somewhere. And the citizens from the two cities go out and have this sort of pitch battle over his body. And the Paduans win and carry him back and then chop him up and put him in these pickle jars. And you're able to line up. And I was not able to get my head round a religion that seems to embody both the most intellectual people on the planet and the worst aspects of what I thought of as folk superstition. It's very strange. And I think Luther felt, when he went to Rome, there was this, on the one hand, he was bowled over by the piety, the opportunities for piety. On the other hand, he was horrified by the corruption of the papal court. And in a later work, he's very good at playing on the rising German, we might say, patriotism And there's this passage in one of his works where he says, you know, I see them now. I see them, the cardinals in Rome, drinking their fine Italian wines and laughing about the stupid beer-drinking Germans who've paid for it all. A similar rhetoric emerged a couple of years ago when Germany was bailing out the whole of the south of Europe in the Euro debacle. But it's interesting that this Rome really colonizes Luther's imagination, and what he sees in 1510 fixes many things for him in his mind for years after. The other thing, though, to remember is that Luther is teaching at a medieval university, and it's really a popular Protestant myth that the Middle Ages had no interest in the Bible or biblical exegesis. Now, the Middle Ages did produce some very fine preachers. I'm scraping around trying to think of one. Bernard of Clairvaux, for example. Hildegard of Bingen. We don't really approve of women preachers, but Hildegard of Bingen was one of the great preachers of the Middle Ages. Preaching was important. It was not as important as the Mass, and it did not occur regularly in parish churches. But there were some great preachers in the Middle Ages. And also, for your man on his way through the university cursus honorum, on his way to an academic career, he would have to lecture through significant books of the Bible. Remember my friend Richard Muller making a comment once in a lecture that he said, there is nobody who teaches at a seminary in North America today who would have been regarded as remotely qualified to teach in a seminary in the Middle Ages, because they simply would not have taught through enough of the Bible. And Luther is required to teach through great chunks of the Bible in his class. Now, he's doing it certainly in his early years from the Vulgate, from the Latin. But he quickly acquires Greek, and we'll move on to working through the Bible in Greek. If you look up Thomas Aquinas in any decent university library catalogue, you'll find that a large part of his work is biblical exegesis. I have his commentary on Romans at home, which it's interesting to compare his commentary on Romans to Luther's commentary or lectures on Romans. So there's some interesting parallels there. And Luther was required to teach through great chunks of the Bible. And in the second decade of the 16th century, he lectures on the Psalms, and he lectures most importantly in 1515 to 1516 on Paul's letter to the Romans. There's actually an interesting text history. Luther's lectures, scholars knew for generations that he'd given these lectures in 1515, 1516, but no copy survived until in the late 19th century. A copy is found at the University of Berlin and the Vatican Library. Two copies show up. And it revolutionizes Luther's studies. You just think of the significance there. 1515, 1516. Those are the years when it's all happening. And we didn't know. We knew that he had lectured on Romans, but we didn't know what he'd said. Well, it revolutionizes Luther's studies. The 20th century revolution in Luther's studies is really triggered by the discovery of these lectures that he gave in 1515, 1516, which provide the immediate background to the crisis of 1517 onwards. So it was an amazing, amazing discovery. And what we learn from these lectures, we learn that Luther's thinking is changing in very, very significant ways. First of all, his view of baptism is changing. Luther had been taught by his medieval masters, that sin was essentially a kind of tinder, a weakness, a liability to burst into flames. And what baptism did was, to put it rather crudely, was sort of dampen this down for a while. Luther comes through his study of Paul to realize that actually sin is not so much to be thought of as tinder or even uncleanness, as to be thought of as death, status of death. When you think about it, that changes everything. To think of sin as death means what? Well, it immediately transfers it to being a status. And if your problem is one status, and the solution, therefore, is going to be translation into another status. If we were to sort of look at medieval teaching on justification, I think by and large, it takes its cue certainly from certain streams of Augustine's thinking. And justification is by and large thought of in transformative terms in the Middle Ages. It's a process of becoming intrinsically more righteous. Once you identify sin as putting you in a status of death, that whole system starts to break down. It starts to break down because the problem becomes, if you like, not substantial, but status. I was some years ago, I was asked to review a book, it must be nearly 20 years ago now, by I shouldn't call her a lady, she's a radical post-Christian feminist, Daphne Hampson. Do you remember the name, Gary? She was a professor at the University of St. Andrews in systematic theology, described herself as a post-Christian feminist. I think I was asked to review the book because nobody else would do it, and I sort of was going to walk into a trap kind of thing, and they assumed that I would pan this book. She wrote a very interesting book on Luther and Kierkegaard. Christian Contradictions, I think, was the title of it. What really fascinated me about the book, though, is the introduction. And the introduction was, there were a couple of fascinating things about the introduction. One, she said she was going to use gender-exclusive language, essentially because she was writing about two men who grew up in patriarchal, misogynistic societies, and she was trying to sort of write as they would write. So I kind of sympathized with her on that front. And the second thing was, she addressed from a post, she said, I've lost my faith, I'm no longer a Christian. This is what I think of ecumenical dialogue. And she raised the point on ecumenical dialogue that the real problem between Protestants and Catholics discussing justification was actually an anthropological one. And she said the problem is that nobody ever addresses the different ways that humanity is understood between Protestantism and Catholicism. Protestantism, she said, understands human beings in terms of status and relation. Catholicism understands human beings in terms of substance. And then she went to the doctrine of justification and said, look at the doctrine of justification. For Protestants, it's a declaration, a translation of status. For Roman Catholics, it's a transformation of substance. And this really depends upon your prior understanding of what it is to be a human being. And until you discuss that, you will not agree on the things that flow from that. And I was very struck by that. And I've thought about that often in the years since. The rest of the book, it's on Kierkegaard, it was way out, way beyond my sphere. But I actually wrote quite a positive review, which I think disappointed the editor because he hoped that I would lose my head as she came after me on this one. But I think that that's an important point, and I think we see it. In the Via Moderna, you're seeing this shift towards human beings being understood in terms of status. For what is it that makes you righteous before God? In the Via Moderna, ultimately, it's not your intrinsic qualities. It's the fact that God has decided to take those intrinsic qualities and declare them to be righteous. You're moving in a status direction. You're moving into a very different thought world. So Luther's change on baptism and sin, it's going to be important because baptism comes for Luther not to symbolize washing or cleansing. It comes to symbolize death and resurrection. This is why in Luther's later writings on baptism, he will say, baptism occurs once in the Christian life with water. But actually, baptism is the whole of the Christian life. For what is a Christian? He's one who's simply dying to self and rising to God, dying and being resurrected every second of every day. This changes things for Luther. Second thing, of course, is it puts the final nail in the coffin of this idea that doing your best will get you there. And Luther comes to think, what is doing your best when you are dead in sins? Luther comes to say, well, doing your best is this. It is despairing that you can do anything at all. And scholars, Luther doesn't use this term, but Luther scholars tend to refer to Luther in 1515, 1516, articulating what we call a theology of humility. That Luther has come to the conviction there that, if you like, the condition of the pactum, the condition that triggers God declaring you to be in a state of grace, is that you come to utterly despair of yourself. It's not quite justification by faith because it doesn't yet have that trust element, but he's nearly there. It's a major breakthrough for Luther. And so in 1515, 1516, studying the book of Romans, he makes this change, this fundamental change in his thinking. What's interesting is nobody cares. Nothing big happens in 1515, 1516. 1517, it all goes down in October, November of that year. So one of the things to draw out of the Luther story in some ways is, you know, Luther's teaching on justification as it emerges is not really the bone of contention. It's not really the thing that triggers the Reformation. We might say at best, it's implications of that doctrine that ultimately get Luther into trouble and excommunicated. So what is it that gets Luther into trouble? Why? How does he make it into the public eye? Well, again, rather odd. You know, we're going to be celebrating, remembering, learning from, whatever, October 1517 this year. 500 years since Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door in Wittenberg. The irony of that event is actually that it's not that radical. And Luther has said more radical things before, and nobody paid a blind bit of attention. If you want to read Luther at his most radical in 1517, then you want to read the Disputation Against Scholastic Theology of September of that year that nobody cared about. Luther offers a far more radical vision of reform of theology there than he does in the 95 Theses, and nobody pays any attention. Why? Well, this is where my training with a Marxist helps. One of the great things that you learn from studying under a Marxist is this. History, to an extent, is like American crime fiction novels. How do you solve them? You follow the money. Follow the money. That's the key. October 1517 will hit the church where it hurts. In money. September, no, nobody really cares whether Luther wants to purge Aristotle from the curriculum. What they care about is whether he's going to hit income streams or not. That's almost me reverting to my earlier super cynical historian mode, but I think it's true here. So why is it? How does 1517 come about then? Well, we need to place Luther's personal story, this angst-ridden path through the book of Romans, we need to set it in the context of bigger story, the European story at this point. A little bit of background we need, a couple of papal bulls that it's worth being familiar with. First of all, papal bull Unigenitus, 1343. Unigenitus establishes what's called the treasury of merits. And, you know, to put it crudely, the idea is this. Although a good Roman Catholic would never, somebody who knows their Catholic theology would never say that human beings themselves generate their own righteousness. It's only ever Christ's righteousness imparted to us. There is this idea that certain individuals, Christ the supreme example, of course, but then also certain great ones among the saints, have generated not simply enough merit for themselves before God, but a surplus. And in the 14th century, the Pope, Clement VI, decides it would be a good idea to establish a kind of cosmic bank account into which this stuff can be placed, the treasury of merits. And that's established by papal bull in 1343. Then in 1476, a second bull, Salvator Noster, links the treasury of merits to the doctrine of purgatory. And this is putting together the theological framework that will be so significant for Luther in 1517. Purgatory starts, I think, don't tweet this. Sometimes I say things that if you tweet them, they really don't mean what I was saying. When I give lectures on transgenderism, I often use the phrase, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. That doesn't tweet very well, you know, it's a sort of Purgatory, I think, starts off relatively harmlessly in the early church. Essentially, it's a kind of clean-up place where you go to after you die, before you pass through to glory. It's an aspect of eschatology, we might say. I think this is the idea. If you read C.S. Lewis, I think it's in his Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. C.S. Lewis seems to kind of hold to a sort of fairly basic view of purgatory. What happens in the later Middle Ages is it gets linked to the penitential system of the church. And then I think it becomes theologically much more significant. And what Salvatore Nostre does is allows for the transfer of merits from the treasury of merits to the account of individual Christians based upon them doing penance. It's a sort of helpful way of supercharging the Christian life and also links it to purgatory so that you're actually able to transfer merit to those languishing in purgatory. This will be very significant because this underlies the whole notion of indulgences. Indulgence. An indulgence is basically a certificate issued by the church that gives you certain time off in purgatory that you can either be applied to yourself or applied to a loved one. It's a way of the church raising funds. And, you know, if you believe the theology that underlies it, it fulfills a certain pastoral function as well. Now, to jump ahead of ourselves a bit, well, one of the things you need to bear in mind is in 1517, Luther does believe in purgatory. That's not really the issue in the 95 Theses. Luther is not putting forward the 95 Theses to repudiate purgatory. What Luther is doing in 1517 is wanting clarification on the church's teaching on indulgences. And it's important to hold that in mind, that we don't over-Protestantize Luther at this point in his career. Go to Rome. What's going on in Rome? Well, the papacy has been exhausted by various wars over recent decades, and is also engaged in the most remarkable building exercise, I think, of the Renaissance. Renaissance Rome is stunning. I've been to St. Peter's twice now. I think my favorite piece of art in the entire world has to be the Pietà by Michelangelo, the statue of the Virgin Mary cradling Christ in her arms after he's come down off the cross. You know, put aside all your Second Commandment issues. That's really beautiful. It's a wonderful piece of art. And some moron smashed it to pieces with a sledgehammer. Was he an Australian? Okay, Hungarian. Some Hungarian Australian. What a combination. Smashed this thing to pieces with a sledgehammer. And they didn't get all the pieces back, apparently, because some tourist went off with pieces. So it's kind of a reconstruction, but it's an amazing piece of art. Michelangelo was 24 when he did that. 24. Yeah, just imagine, what were you doing when you were 24? Probably not putting together one of the greatest pieces of artwork the West has ever known. And when you go into the Sistine Chapel, it's stunning to look at the ceiling and to realize that Michelangelo, he didn't even consider himself a painter. He's a sculptor. Painting was what he kind of did on the side when he had to. Well, these guys, you know, Raffaello, Michelangelo, they don't come cheap. They're expensive. This is a major expensive project that Renaissance papacy is engaging in. And the papacy is in serious financial trouble at this point and needs to generate income streams. By the way, when I went to the Vatican, my last time I went over there, we went around with a tour guide who pointed out the different things that Michelangelo did. He put a gay kiss in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. But apparently he was a homosexual, had strong tendencies that way, and this was sort of stick it to the church. I'd never seen it before. There it is. And one of the cardinals who complained about this Michelangelo painted him in the nude, apparently. And this cardinal complained to the Pope, and the Pope kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, what can I do? He's an artist. You know, they're rule unto the law unto themselves. But there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek, surreptitious humor in the Sistine Chapel. But he, you know, he's a genius. The normal rules shouldn't apply to geniuses, I guess. But the church is in need of, serious need of income streams. And this is provided by happenings near Luther. There is a young bishop, Albrecht of Mainz. Albrecht of Mainz has two bishoprics. And bishoprics are, they're useful things to have because they come with tax-raising powers. And Albrecht wants to add a third bishopric to his tally. The problem is that church canon law prevents the holding of more than two bishoprics unless you buy a special license from the papacy. So what happens is Albrecht strikes a deal with the Pope, Leo X. He strikes a deal with the Pope whereby he is allowed to buy a license for a vast sum of money. To do this, he borrows a huge sum of money from the Fugger Bank in Germany. And the Pope then agrees to allow Albrecht to raise an indulgence in the empire where half of the indulgence money will go to help pay off the interest on the loan. And the other half will go to the papacy. So it's a brilliant deal. The papacy get the money for the indulgence. For the license. And they get half the proceeds from the indulgence. This is a hugely beneficial deal for both Albrecht and the papacy. And the indulgence, the selling of the indulgence, is handed to a man called Johann Tetzel. You have to feel sorry for Tetzel. Because Luther will destroy, you know, Luther. There's a wonderful book come out last year, Brand Luther, written by an old friend of mine, Andrew Pettigrew, professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews. And it's a study of how Luther used print medium to create himself, essentially. And one of the things that Andrew does in that is he shows how Luther used print medium to utterly destroy Tetzel. Tetzel dies a few years later, an utterly broken and discredited man. Because when Luther hated somebody, boy, he hated them. He went after them with a vengeance and he didn't let up until there was nothing left. Tetzel is a Dominican. And he's given the duty of selling the indulgence. He's a brilliant salesman. Luther alludes in the 95 Theses to two of Tetzel's sales pitches. One of them is translated in English now as the little jingle. Every time a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. We laugh at that, but just think about the power that would have. If you genuinely believe this system, and you genuinely believe that indulgences have the power to release loved ones from purgatory, and you genuinely believe that your grandmother or your father is in purgatory, and you did a long stretch in purgatory. You didn't do like 2 years and then you get out. You're talking of tens of thousands of years. If you genuinely believe this system, then that sale pitch is going to be very, very powerful. I often think of that when you look at some of these terrible televangelists and you see how, you know, they have their credit card thing flicking across the bottom of the screen and you give more money. They're just indulgent salesmen. But their pitch has power because people genuinely believe. If Benny Hinn prays for me, maybe my cancer will go away, so I'll give him my money. You can see the grip this kind of thing has on people's imaginations perennially. Well, the Protestants may be best at selling indulgences today. The Catholics were the best in the 16th century. That is a powerful sales pitch. The other one, which is of more profane vintage, is, you know, if you have raped the Virgin Mary, one of my indulgences will be enough to square it away. Tetzel appears to be a very, very profane man. And he starts to make his way up through the empire. He's not allowed into Electoral Saxony. And he's not allowed into Electoral Saxony for a very interesting reason. Frederick the Wise, the Elector of Saxony, has the greatest collection of relics north of the Alps. Have any of you seen the Luther movie? There's that scene, isn't there, at the end of the movie where Luther goes into the relics room and Frederick's there, and Frederick, played by Peter Ustinov, I love Peter Ustinov as an actor, perfect for Frederick the Wise, you know, basically says to Luther, you know, my entire collection, you just made it rubbish. It's all gone. Probably never happened. Frederick the Wise and Luther never appear to have met, which is quite an achievement. If you go to Wittenberg, it's a pretty small town. Frederick the Wise always used a mediator with Luther, I think, so that if everything went wrong, he could walk away and say, nothing to do with me, Gov. He could turn to the emperor and say, oh, yeah, I have nothing to do with Luther at all. He always used his secretary, a man called George Spalatin, to carry the messages to Luther. Frederick the Wise won't allow Tetzel to come into Wittenberg or into Electoral Saxony because it would spoil his own trade in relics. But what happens is Luther's parishioners start crossing the river into Ducal Saxony, the neighboring territory, and buying indulgences there. And there's that bit in the movie where Luther's walking down the street and he bumps into the girl and she's carrying a baby, and I'm not sure if the movie makes it clear whether it's her baby or it's a younger sister or something. And Luther says to her, you know, have you used the money to buy food and clothing for the kid? And she says, no, I bought something much better. And she produces this piece of paper and waves this indulgence at him. You know, I bought an indulgence. And Luther turns around, you know, look of thunder, and you think, man, the Reformation, it's about to go down. It's all happening tonight, kind of thing. Didn't happen like that. In actual fact, the story, I think, of Luther's repudiation of questioning of indulgences is more interesting than that. Luther is, it's in January, February, I think, of 1517. Luther is preaching in the church in Wittenberg, and he's preaching a standard, I think it's a standard 60-day indulgence. And halfway through this sermon, he suddenly changes direction. My friend Tim Wengert, who taught at the Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia, was telling me about this just recently. He sort of uncovered this and is convinced this is the moment. Halfway through the sermon, as we have it recorded, Luther suddenly says, effectively says, hang on a minute, I can't see how this can work. And he starts to preach against indulgences at that point. And apparently the elector is absolutely furious. He sees the significance of this. But it seems that Luther is, in effect, he's preaching this sermon, and suddenly he becomes convinced that what he's teaching can't possibly work. And that really sets up what happens in October 1517 when Luther posts his 95 theses on the castle door. It's important, you know, it's interesting to ask, what exactly does he think he's doing there? We are at this point the victims, I think, of dreadful 19th century artwork. Generally speaking, when you look at 19th century depictions of Luther nailing up the 95 Theses, one, he's far too tall. He was a tiny, chubby little guy. He wasn't chubby in 1517, of course. He was a monk living on a pretty meager diet. He gets chubby after he marries his wife and she starts to cook a whole lot, make sure he's eating and cooking a whole lot better for him. But the sort of the iconography of 19th century paintings of Luther is very much that there he is, you know, driving a nail into the coffin of the church or driving a stake through the heart of the church. Much more mundane than that. The castle door is the place where, you know, it's a bit like the church notice board today. If you advertise something on the church notice board, it's not necessarily significant that you've chosen the church notice board, other than the fact that that's the place where people see notices. The castle door would have been the place to put up announcements. Second thing about it is, if you read the 95 Theses, it's an interesting document, but it's hardly one you'd have thought likely to set the world on fire. Quite a bit of it is fairly arcane, and you need to know a fair bit about late medieval theology to know exactly what Luther's getting at. In some ways, the first thesis is the most dramatic. When our Lord said, repent, he meant the whole of life should be one of repentance. In some ways, that's the high mark of the 95 Theses. But what Luther is really doing is he's looking at this practice. He's thinking, this can't possibly be right, that what Tetzel is saying, what the indulgence mongers are saying, can't possibly be right. And he's calling for a university debate that will lead to clarification on the church's teaching on indulgences. You see, there's all kinds of interesting stuff about the Pope in the 95 Theses that we're tempted now to read as anti-papal statements. Things to the effect of, you know, if this is true, if the Pope had this power, then he'd let everybody out of purgatory. I think what Luther's saying there is, what you, Tetzel, are saying can't possibly be true. Because if the Pope did have this power, he would let people out of purgatory. It's not actually an anti-papal statement, so much as it is saying, look, what you're saying locally can't be the church's official teaching, because it would be absolute nonsense if that was the case. So the 95 Theses, I think, is in some ways not as polemical a treatise as we like to think it is. But it has a huge impact. Within weeks, Luther, whether the 95 Theses is ever translated is debated. A man called Isolo, a Jesuit historian, argued that Luther never actually posted the 95 Theses. I think that's been more or less discredited as an idea. What really becomes significant is Luther's explanation of the 95 Theses. It's this that becomes the popular pamphlet. Luther strikes a chord. Of all of the things that trigger the Reformation, the 95 Theses, it's odd that it does that, but it somehow strikes a chord. It strikes a chord with theologians who are uncomfortable with what appears to be church teaching and practice. It strikes a chord with the peasants who feel they're being exploited by the church. It strikes a chord with the knights and the nobility who are tired of the tax burden flowing from north to south. What Luther's 95 Theses and the explanation thereof does is create this strange coalition that will really hang together for pretty much 8 years and carry the Reformation so far that there can be no going back. It's a very, very interesting coalition. I remember reading years ago, I think it was Karl Barth, who, describing his commentary on Romans that caused such a stir in 1919, and talking about wondering when Romans was published, he felt as like a man walking along in the dark, a corridor in the dark, and tripping over and throwing out his hands before him to stop himself falling down, and catching hold of a rope and pulling down hard on the rope, and high above him hearing a church bell ringing. It's a dramatic image of the unexpected Reformation. And I think in some ways, that's what we have with Luther in 1517. He's not calling for a reformation of the church at this point. He's calling for a clarification of the church's teaching on indulgences. And what's absolutely fascinating about all this, of course, is that one of the first things the church will do, Rome will do, when it receives a complaint about Luther, is it will establish a committee to try to clarify exactly what the church teaching on indulgences is. Again, I think we one of the things we tend to do is when we go back to Roman Catholicism in the early 16th century, we look at it through a post-Trent, post-Vatican I, post-Vatican II lens, and tend to assume that the church knew what it believed and held that very self-consciously. In actual fact, I think in some ways the genius of medieval Catholicism was it was more or less chaotic. I love that comedy, Father Ted. Gary's also a Father Ted fan. There's a line in Father Ted, he says the great thing about Catholicism is nobody's quite sure what it believes anyway. That's definitely the Catholicism of the late Middle Ages. It's a relatively chaotic, but it kind of works. You know, that's the genius of it. It's a mess, but it works. When Luther starts calling for clarification on these things, the church is thrown into something of a panic because it's got to actually start thinking about what it really believes about these kind of things. And I myself am convinced that Luther felt that there was a legitimate form of indulgence in 1517. What he's concerned about is false teaching about indulgences, not teaching about indulgences too core. The distinction I would draw is what Luther is concerned about is that people think that the grace of God can be bought without any existential transformation of the individual. I'll give an example. You know, one of you sins against me in some way. Say, you know, well, let's say I go home and I find that my sons, in my absence, have borrowed my car and have trashed it. And I confront them over it, and they laugh and say, well, you know, Dad, it was old car anyway, and we had good fun smashing it up. Here's $1,000, you can go and replace it. That, I think, is the kind of indulgence that Luther fears Tetzel is selling, where forgiveness can be bought by a mere cash transaction. Same scenario, and I confront my sons, and they're brokenhearted. They're convicted of their sin. They're brokenhearted, and I say to them, you know, well, how much money have you got? And they say, we've got $1,000. And I say, okay, give me every last penny, and I'll forgive you. And they give me the $1,000, and I forgive them. Not because they've given me $1,000. I forgive them because the $1,000 is a sign that they've genuinely repented of their sin at that point. Same cash transaction, two entirely different moral scenarios. And I think what Luther fears in 1517, and rightly fears, given the way Tetzel is selling these things, what he fears is that this is cheapening the grace of God. It's allowing God's grace to be traded like a commodity on the open market. We shouldn't overestimate the Protestantism of Luther at this point. Certainly, Luther himself did not do so. I've got a quotation here from 1545. We must bear in mind, of course, 1545 is, you know, nearly 30 years on. Luther is, he's not well. He dies in 1546. He's an old man remembering events from long ago that have been replayed again and again in his mind and probably distorted over and over again. And his life has been full of action and trauma, so his memory may not be super great, but it would be unlikely, I think, that he would miss something so fundamental. And he says this, "Above all things, I beseech the Christian reader and beg him for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ to read my earliest books very circumspectly and with much pity, knowing that before now I too was a monk and one of the right frantic and raving papists. When I took up this matter against indulgences, I was so full and drunken, yea, so besotted in papal doctrine, that out of my great zeal I would have been ready to do murder. At least I would have been glad to see and help that murder should be done on all who would not be obedient and subject to the Pope, even to his smallest word." And I'm inclined to take Luther at face value there. I don't think the Luther of 1517 is yet fully Protestant. I think his theology of humility that emerges in 1516 means that it's clearly going to be anathema to him that somebody thinks they can buy God's grace. You have to have despaired of self. You have to have felt the pain of sin. You have to have felt the pain of being dead in your sins in order for God to be gracious to you. But he's not yet a Protestant. This is not a protest over justification by grace through faith. This is a protest over the financial abuse of Luther's parishioners that becomes an issue to him because his parishioners are crossing the river to Uteborg and Zerbst and returning with these worthless pieces of paper, having given away their good money to the church to help fund the building of St. Peter's and Michelangelo's artwork down in Rome. So 1517 then is a key moment, and I think it's right that we remember it this year. But in some ways, other than being a protest, it's not a particularly Protestant moment. Luther's Protestantism will develop in some ways behind the scenes up until 1517 and only become really explicit in 1520. One of the things I want to note just at this point is one of the things that becomes very clear at this moment is Luther's grasp of the power of the printing press, the power of media. Again, go to Andrew Pettigrew's book, Brand Luther. It's a fascinating read. And if Luther has, you know, if Napoleon's genius was that he could look at a battlefield when his men were heavily outnumbered and know exactly where to put his battalions in order to win a victory, Luther has this uncanny grasp of the print medium from the word go in the Reformation. I think it's hard to know where it comes from. Andrew Pettigrew does this amazing job of showing how Luther was even fussy about the fonts that were used to print his books, because he understood that some fonts were more attractive and easier to read than others. Papyrus font. Luther would never have invented that, I don't think, in a million years. But he had an understanding of the power of the print medium. And of course, think about what printing does. Printing allows, for the first time really in Western history, for the creation of public opinion. You need, in order to create public opinion, you need a medium that disseminates things rapidly and in a stable form over large areas of territory. And Luther's 95 Theses, and particularly the explanation of the 95 Theses, becomes a bestseller. And Luther will capitalize again and again on the print medium. Again, we're good Protestants. We don't want to reduce the Reformation to the printing press. But the printing press is vital right from the word go. Luther would never have been heard of. His protest may never have been heard of if these things hadn't been printable and distributable very, very rapidly over huge tracts of space. The other thing to note as well is Luther also understood the power of pictures. One of the things I got this year was a copy of Luther's 1545 German Bible. And the illustrations are superb. They leave nothing to the imagination, we might say. There is a certain irony, I think, to a word-based religion disseminating its message through pictures. But Luther lives in a world of 95% plus illiteracy. So how do you get the word out? Word of mouth and pictures. Word of mouth and pictures. And that's how Luther will spread his gospel. So 1517, we see, I think, the collision in 1517 of Luther's own personal exploration of late medieval theology and his development of that as he's found it inadequate to deal with his own existential questions and needs, colliding with the church's economic policy, colliding with its chaos over indulgences, and capitalizing on disillusionment at all levels of German society and the existence of the printing press. That's what makes Luther such a roaring success from 1517 onwards. Next section, I want to go and look at Luther's idea of the theology of the cross, but I can't do that in the 10 minutes left available to us. So I'll throw it open now for any questions that have come up in the first couple of lectures. If you want to leave Luther and the Jews to the end, that might help, because that's not a quick answer. Luther and the Jews is a longer answer. Yes, sir.
In the movie, it seems that Luther has sympathy with orthodoxy when his professor says, of course, there is no salvation outside the Catholic Church, and the actor says,
yep.
What about the Greek church? And did he draw upon a lot of the body of writing and church fathers from the Orthodox Church?
Good question. Certainly Luther is familiar with the Eastern early church fathers. To the extent that he's familiar with medieval Orthodox theology, Gregory Palamas or somebody like that, I've never come across any references to Palamas in his thinking. There's a very influential school of Lutheran thought that I myself have written a critique of that's risen in Finland in the last 15, 20 years, that's tried to argue that Luther's theology is actually very close to Eastern notions of theosis. I disagree with that. I think the problem, there are a number of problems with that. One of them is that the sources they draw on for Luther's thinking tend to be pre-1518 sources, very early sources for Luther. I think the best way to judge Luther's mature thinking is in relation to the confessional materials that are produced by Luther. But certainly he's familiar with Eastern Orthodox thinking, and I think he's deeply rooted in the categories of classical Trinitarian theism as developed in the early church. There's a book, Dominus Mortis, been written recently by an American professor at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I think making a good case for Luther believing in impassibility, which is kind of counter a lot of thinking on Luther's scholarship. But I think he does a decent job of arguing that and showing how he connects to to the ancient church. So I would say, yes, in terms of the early church fathers. I'm not sure about the medieval Eastern Orthodoxy. I'm not sure that that part of the movie would have any historical origin. I just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is about Luther and Erasmus. I've read that Luther made some quite positive comments about Erasmus in his early writings, and it was in his later writings that he became much more aggressive about Erasmus. So you said at the start when you were setting the context of Luther's historical setting that he was very much rooted in medievalism and was kind of not pro-Erasmus's humanism. But I guess that just seems at odds with what I've read about Luther being positive about Erasmus in his early writings. Yeah. So could you talk about that?
I think the year 1524, well, the years 1524, 1525 are watersheds for Luther and his relation to Erasmus, because that's when Erasmus around about 1519, Frederick the Wise approaches Erasmus and asks for his opinion on Luther. And Erasmus makes the comment, well, he's attacked the Pope's luxury and the monks' bellies. Erasmus sees Luther as attacking the morality of the church, which is really to underestimate what Luther's doing. But Erasmus also provides Frederick the Wise with some confidential notes on what he thinks about Luther that are published. Because everyone wants, Erasmus is a giant, and everybody wants to be able to claim Erasmus as being on their side. The net result of that leak to the press is that Erasmus writes Diatribe on Free Will and really dramatically breaks with the Luther Project, or identifies himself as being not on board with the Luther Project and the Diatribe on Free Will. So 1524, 1525, when Erasmus clearly breaks with Luther, it's really after that you get a lot of the anti-Erasmus stuff. Prior to that, Luther uses the tools that Erasmus has produced. He's produced the Greek Testament. I think Luther, like all, would hope that Erasmus was going to come over to the Protestant Reformation. That isn't Erasmus, though. Erasmus he's your elitist critic of the church who's never going to put his neck on the line. He's happy to poke fun at the church, but when push comes to shove, he's always going to side with the establishment. So I think the comments you're looking at, I would guess that any positive comments would have to come prior to 1524, 1525. After that, Melanchthon, Luther's right-hand man, gets hold of the Diatribe on Free Will and reads it, he thinks it's fantastic. I mean, Melanchthon's a bit of a liability theologically. He goes running to Luther and says, this is great, the big man is with us. Erasmus is on our side. Luther reads this thing and he's horrified. He goes into a depression because he knows this is Erasmus. You can ignore loonies. You can ignore the 16th century equivalent of the guy in his mother's basement with a blog having a pot shot. But this is Erasmus. This is a very serious man who's basically trashed the central tenets of Luther's theology. And he has to, Luther then has to come out with a hammer at that point.
I'm trying to get my mind into Luther's reality and his opposition to the humanism. Luther's opposition to Erasmus comes out at that later stage for political reasons, but in his early era, he could be quite positive of Erasmus, even though he's coming with that humanism, and I'm just trying to get my head into
Well, Luther's not opposed to humanism. He's not a humanist. But, Melanchthon, one of his closest friends and his right-hand man in Wittenberg, is an Erasmian humanist. So Luther's not opposed to humanism. He didn't train as a humanist himself. But he's not opposed to the literary project that is humanism. What he is really is opposed to Erasmus, that he regards as a spineless, two-faced scum of the earth. He despises Erasmus. So until Erasmus clearly declares against the Reformation, Luther would not have regarded him necessarily as being, wicked on the grounds he's a humanist. It's not Erasmus's humanism that Luther despises. It's his non-dogmatic approach to Christianity. Luther's, Erasmus says, Erasmus is your archetypal. Christianity isn't a set of doctrines. It's a way of life, man. And Luther comes back and says, no, it's a set of doctrines. You know, it's, you take away assertions and you take away Christianity. And Erasmus has taken away assertions. He's taken away the clarity of Scripture. He's said that his salvation depends partly upon his own will. Erasmus has destroyed Christianity. Now, none of those positions Erasmus holds are necessarily humanist positions, but they are held by Erasmus.
Professor, I might just ask you, you've made some allusion to the thing I was thinking about, which is, could you say something about potential distinctions between Luther, the mature Protestant, and second-generation Lutheranism? You've written Lutheran, the Christian yeah. Life, and some of the Lutheran scholars I know are keen to make distinctions on specifically that point, and yeah. I just wonder what you might have to say.
Well, I'm not drawing an analogy with the way Calvin and or the first generation Reformed and the later generation Reformed are related. There's often a lot of church politics of the current day that plays into that kind of debate. So I'm guessing that may affect Lutheran scholarship as well. But certainly what you see in second generation Lutheranism, you'll see a systematizing of theology that's not there in Luther. Now, I want to qualify what I've said there. A lot of people, I read this just the other week, friend of mine from the UK, Alec Ryrie, he's a sort of liberal Protestant, and he wrote this thing, written a book, and he makes the comment that Luther's not a systematic theologian. I suspect what he means is that Luther is kind of chaotic theologically. I would want to say no, Luther's actually remarkably consistent as a theologian, but he never writes systematic theology. But as Lutheranism becomes instantiated in the university, and Europe divides up confessionally among territories, and it becomes important for territories to define themselves theologically, that's something that's very difficult for us to get our heads around in the 21st century, but you know, your confession was a political thing. Lutheranism inevitably becomes more concerned about system and structure. So a lot of the second generation Lutherans are more concerned about system and structure. The big thing is the Lord's Supper. And second generation Lutheranism divides on the Lord's Supper. There are two versions of the Augsburg Confession, the great confession of Lutheranism. One is 1530, one is in 1540. The 1530 confession is very clearly Lutheran on the Lord's Supper. It was written by Melanchthon. The 1540 confession is also written by Melanchthon, but he takes out some key elements that make it more ambiguous. So Calvin is able to subscribe the 1540 Augsburg confession. What happens after Luther dies is you have this incredible power struggle between Luther's disciples. They divide into the Philippists, the followers of Melanchthon, and the so-called Genesio Lutherans, the real Lutherans, the hardcore guys. And the big issues that divide them are the bondage of the will, where the Philippists are more concessive, and the Lord's Supper, where the Philippists lean more in a Calvinist direction. And to cut a long story short, the Genesio Lutherans win. So later confessional Lutheranism has a strong emphasis upon the Lord's Supper, which you don't typically find so much in Reformed and evangelical circles. We struggle as to why Lutherans are so hung up on this. It's actually a vital part of their history, given the post-Luther struggles. I've spoken now twice at Missouri Synod gatherings. I'm amazed I get asked, because my view of the Lord's Supper should really render me anathema to them. But I think I like Luther enough, they kind of give me a green card or something to let me in. But I went, two years ago, I spoke at the Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne, and it was fun. There was 400 Lutherans and me, one Reform guy. And I like those odds, 400 to one. And man, they beat me black and blue on the Lord's Supper. It was tremendous fun for 2 days. So I was kind of glad to get away alive at the end. But the Lord's Supper and the communication of properties between the human and the divine in Christ, of which their doctrine rests, that becomes very, very important in the Lutherans. Very, very important. One more and then we'll break for lunch. Yeah?
Was Martin Luther happy with the robust debates that occurred in the university after 1517? Did it meet his expectations, and did it do what he wanted to do in those debates?
The 95 Theses debate never takes place. That's interesting. It takes on life its own, but the debate never takes place. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk about the debate that takes place at Heidelberg, where I think Luther's Reformation theology is much more radical at Heidelberg than he is in Wittenberg in October 1517. I think, again, we've got to go back. I think Luther doesn't know where he's going with this stuff. He's making it up as he goes along, by and large, at this point. And happy is an odd category to try to use. Was he happy with these debates? I think he learned a lot from them, particularly the debate at Leipzig in 1519, when he's beaten, he's hammered by John Eck, the Roman Catholic. But he learns a lot from it, and it really John Eck really helps Luther see what it's been about all along. It's been about authority, and Luther doesn't really notice that until 1519. Thankfully, rather distasteful, Eck undoes himself because he writes this letter from Leipzig saying how great the prostitutes were in Leipzig. And it, the Lutherans get hold of this, and although he wins the debate, it ruins his reputation. And you can imagine the Lutherans getting hold of this document, and wow, we can really crush the guy now. What they'd have done in the age of the internet, goodness only knows. These guys were dangerous. Okay, we'll take a break, and 2 o'clock we convene for the lectures. Great. We'll do Heidelberg at 2 o'clock.